This is the Michael Lerner Conference with Common Will for March 16th, 2006, beginning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time.
Again, I'd like to mention to folks who have just come on the line that our next regularly scheduled CHAID National Partnership call is next week on March 22nd at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern. We'll be focusing on endocrine disruptors and environmental health 10 years after our Stolen Future was published. It'll be very interesting, and we will be having Dr. Pete Myers, Dr. Theo Colborn, and Diane Dumanowski on that call. They were the authors of that book.
This is Phil Lee. I'm going to have to miss that because I'm going to be giving a talk at the 100th anniversary of the FDA.
Oh, wonderful.
Oh, wonderful.
Same time.
Well, that's a good excuse.
Relevant issue.
We hope to get a copy of your remarks, Phil.
Okay. I'll be very glad to do that.
Thank you.
Especially about preemption.
So I'd like to ask Julia Varshovsky, my CHAID colleague, if she has a chance to try to reach Phil Landrigan while we're on the line. That would be really great. I don't want to wait too much longer. We're at 4 minutes after nine. So, Elise, would you like to start in the meantime?
Sure, I would be happy to. And
wonderful.
I want to welcome everyone. I'm Elise Miller, and I'm Executive Director of the Institute for Children's Environmental Health, and I'm also the National Coordinator of CHAID's Learning and Developmental Disabilities Initiative, and very pleased that we could have this special call on the National Children's Study. I think most of you know that in the proposed federal budget, which was released February 6th, there are Disease Control and Health Resources and Services Administration, and this could mean some major concerns for health promotion and prevention activities. And one of the programs that is recommended to be cut is the National Children's Study, and that is, of course, why we are having this call and why all of you are joining us. We're going to start with our usual science update for the CHAID call. And Ted Shetler, who's the science director of the Science and Environmental Health Network, will provide that. Ted?
Well, hi, just a second, Elise. I just wanted to insert a couple of pieces of information.
I'm Ted, sorry. Did
again. That's okay. I just wanted to let everyone know really quickly. I mentioned about the website resources several times on our healthandenvironment.org website. Also, I just wanted to let other folks know that we will be placing everyone on the line in mute mode during the duration of the presenter so that we don't have a lot of ambient noise. And also that once we are finished with the presentations, the operator will put all of us in talk and listen mode so that we can do the Q&A process after the presenters have spoken. And just to let you know that when you do ask your question during the Q&A period, please be sure to identify yourself before you speak and keep your comment or question brief. And just also, I'd like to let everyone know that we do record these calls and that we offer an audio MP3 file and transcript on the CHAID website, typically within a week or two after the calls. And now, before Ted does his science update, I'd like to ask Adam, our operator, to place everyone in listen-only mode. And when you're done with that, please let me know. Thank you.
That is happening as we speak.
So can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Ted.
Thank you, Eleni. And Ted Shetler, please go ahead.
Okay, thanks. I wanted to just very briefly describe two studies which I think actually have a fair amount of relevance to today's main topic. The first one is a very recently released study of an ongoing farm worker study in California in which the scientists examined 130 pregnant women and their newborns to study the status of an enzyme that detoxifies organophosphate pesticides in these individuals. That enzyme is called pyroxinase, or PON, and what it does is help to metabolize organophosphate pesticides and facilitates their excretion. So a low enzyme or PON status implies that the pesticide lingers longer in the body, and the enzyme status is genetically determined. So these participants all come from a region in California where a large amount of organophosphate pesticides are used in commercial agriculture. More than 48,000 pounds are used annually. And previous studies in this community have shown that people who live there have higher organophosphate pesticide exposures than people in other parts of the country. And studies in this same cohort that have been previously published have shown a relationship between higher organophosphate pesticide exposures and shortened gestational age in pregnancy and abnormal reflexes in the neonates. Many of these participants work in the fields during pregnancy, and 82% of them had agricultural workers living in their homes. So here's what they found. They measured the enzyme levels in these individuals, as I mentioned, genetically determined. And then based on that, their data predict, and I'm going to describe findings for two different organophosphate pesticides because their metabolism is slightly different, and that's why they separate them. For one of them, which is called diazinon, there is a range of sensitivity to diazinon of 26-fold within the newborns and 14-fold within the mothers. That means that some newborns have a sensitivity that's 26 times higher than the least sensitive newborns, and that range was 14-fold for the mothers. The range of sensitivity between the most sensitive newborn and the most resistant mother is predicted to be about 65-fold. On average, newborns were four times more sensitive than their mothers to this pesticide. Now, for the second organophosphate pesticide, which is chlorpyrifos, there was an estimated 130 to 160-fold range of sensitivity between the most sensitive newborn and the most resistant mother. That's 130 to 164 times. On average, newborns are 8 to 10-fold more sensitive than their mothers. So the authors concluded, these data predict that most, but if not all, newborns, as well as a subpopulation of adults, will exhibit significantly increased sensitivity to organophosphate pesticide exposure. These findings highlight the significance of understanding the susceptibility of young children to organophosphate pesticide exposure and developing science-based risk standards for pesticide regulation as required by the Food Protection Act. Now, that's that study. Let me just very quickly comment on another one that's being done across the country at Columbia University, where scientists there have been studying mother-infant pairs for some time now. And they've shown that there's an increased risk of developmental delays and reduced scores on neurological testing of infants in children whose mothers were more highly exposed to chlorpyrifos during pregnancy when compared to a lower exposure group. But interestingly, the findings were most marked in a subset of women who were particularly economically disadvantaged and had experienced material hardships during the previous year, including lack of food, clothing, or shelter. Now, other studies also show the influence of yet another factor, and that is nutritional status of mothers during pregnancy on the neurological development of their children. So in conclusion, or in summary, one might say that neurological development of children is influenced by exposures to environmental chemicals during fetal development, genetic inheritance, social circumstances, and maternal nutrition. In order to more fully understand the relative importance of these factors individually and their collective interactions, prospective studies that carefully examine a number of different variables are essential. And that brings me back then to today's call, because this really is the intention of the National Children's Study, which is the topic of today's call, to begin to collect data on multiple variables prospectively in order to better understand some of these subtle and important interactions. So I'll stop there, Elise.
Thank you so much, Ted. That was a very clearly articulated update and obviously significant for this call. So that, thank you very much. Is Dr. Phil Landergan on? Has he been able to join us?
I don't think so.
It sounds like he isn't available yet, and I'm sure Julia or others are working to get him on the line. So we'll turn to Joe Merrill, who's Director of Public Policy and Government Affairs at the March of Dimes. And Joe, perhaps you could provide a little more of an overview of the status of the National Children's Study. I know that wasn't your directive on this call, but as a way to start us out, and hopefully Dr. Lanigan will join us. Joe?
Sure. This is Joe Merrill, and I really was going to talk about why the March of Dimes is interested in this, but I'm happy to, I think anybody who's looked at some of the background on your website, which is great, actually, would have probably a good feel for the study. This was something that was authorized in the Children's Health Act of 2000, and NICHD was given the lead as the lead agency, but it also has several other agencies involved. It's the National Institute of Environmental Health Science at NIH and EPA, and then there's a whole slew of other federal agencies that are involved in other ways. And planning for this has been going on since the 2000 bill was signed into law. I guess the most significant event was last fall when NICHD announced that the Vanguard sites, there were seven Vanguard sites, were picked, and they're the sites around the country that are actually going to do the piloting of the study. And so we're in that stage now and hoping that we will get to the implementation stage where another 101 sites would be added around the country. This is a study of, we hope, 100,000 children from before birth, in many cases to age 21. At this point, it all rests in the funding, which is one of the reasons that I think we're having this call, too. I'm sure Phil will get on and be able to talk more about the details of the Vanguard sites, hypothesis-driven, all that. I really do focus on the legislative side generally. So let me just go into a little bit about the March of Dimes and why this has become a very high legislative priority for us. As some of you probably know, the March of Dimes is a national voluntary health agency founded in 1938 by Franklin Roosevelt to prevent polio. Today, the organization works to improve the health of mothers, infants, and children by preventing birth defects, prematurity, and infant mortality. You can see that the National Children's Study is closely aligned with the mission of the March of Dimes, and that's why it has been a legislative priority for us since 2000. And in fact, I think there were March of Dimes people involved with the planning even before it was authorized. Throughout the Children's Study, there will be groundbreaking research that will greatly increase our knowledge of the roles family genetics and environment play in childhood development. In January 2003, the March of Dimes initiated its current prematurity campaign, which is a 10-year project focused on reducing the rates of preterm birth in this country. Last year, there were approximately 500,000 babies born preterm. That's less than 37 completed weeks of gestation. And prematurity is the leading killer of newborns. Preterm babies are 14 times more likely than other infants to die in the first year of life. And those who survive are often left with serious and long-term disabilities, including cerebral palsy, mental retardation, chronic lung disease, whatever. Prematurity obviously is costly in economic terms as well. In 2000, the total hospital bill, national hospital bill for premature babies, was more than $18 billion. About half of that was paid by employers and the other half by public programs such as Medicaid. And finally, to make matters worse, prematurity is a growing problem. The rate has increased by nearly 30% since 1981. So the first stage of the Children's Study would yield critical information for research on prematurity. You know, the study would start with, pregnant women and then the infants, and so we would expect the first results to come out after a couple of years, and they would, we think, give us very critical information on prematurity. And this will enable scientists and clinicians to develop interventions, treatment, and preventive measures to help these families. In addition, the Children's Study will generate information that will help to reduce the incidence, we hope, of serious birth defects. Birth defects are the leading cause of death in the first year of life and can cause physical and mental disabilities that last a lifetime. In 2004, there were 120,000 babies born with one or more significant birth defects that we don't know the causes for between 60 and 70% of them. So there is no more urgent need than to find the causes of these health problems, something that can be accomplished, we think, through the National Children's Study. It's so important to the March of Dimes, in fact, that our Office of Government Affairs staff, and that's me and several others here, have been spearheading with the American Academy of Pediatrics and others an informal coalition to support this study. think I'll stop there because I know you got Karen will be from AAP will be talking about exactly what we've been doing on the funding side. And Phil will probably bring people up to date on the latest efforts with a new coalition that's been formed.
Well, thank you so much, Joe. And I, as you're speaking, I realize I want to acknowledge there are a number of organizations whom I believe are represented on this call as participants who have been very instrumental since the inception of the study, or even preconception, so to speak, of the study, in developing the protocols and the priorities. And so I really want to acknowledge that along with the March of Dimes. There are others on the call, and I hope that you all will be able to speak up or ask questions towards the end of the call. So I'll ask once again if Dr. Phil Landergan has been able to join us.
Hi, Elise. This is Julia. I just wanted to let everyone know that I got in touch with Phil's office, and his building has been evacuated.
Oh,
he's on his way in right now and should be on the call shortly.
Okay. Thank you, Julia, for that update. Life's eventualities. Assume everyone's okay if they're moving back in. So, Karen, if you don't mind, I'm going to call on you next. Karen Hendricks is with the Department of Federal Affairs, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and has been focusing on the legislative efforts to restore the National Children's Study funding, and also prior to this later iteration, they've been very instrumental in working towards getting the study conceived and implemented. Karen.
Okay, thanks. Joe Merrill, my colleague, has outlined some of the background of our partnership and of collaborating with our colleagues, primarily inside the Beltway, on looking at and focusing on, over the last several years, funding for and sufficient funding for the National Children's Study. Even as we speak, in a little over an hour, one of the amendments that we have all been toiling in the vineyard for the last week is an amendment that would overall increase funding in the budget by some $7 billion that would allow more funding, at least in the Senate's version of the budget resolution, for the labor HHS appropriations. As well as, because it's not focused on one aspect of labor HHS overall in the budget, that will prove to be extremely important to ensure that NIH, CDC, the other agencies are at least attempted to get us back to the FY 2005 levels. While that wasn't perfect, it is a marked improvement from where we are. So that's one level of activity, looking at the whole of the National Institutes of Health, CDC, and the like, and then obviously working for the working on the part. There are two appropriations committees on the House and the Senate side, because as you know, the funding is primarily spearheaded by NIH, NICHD in particular. I think the preponderance of the money, some $7 million, is in NICHD. But the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and EPA and the National Institutes of Environmental Health also at NIH are the other components. So it's not just one, it's not just the health subcommittee, but it's also the subcommittee on interior, environment, and related agencies on both the House and Senate side. And our task is going to be, as we've done over the last several years, to really focus on those subcommittees, and I would add now with the named seven Vanguard sites, and those seven sites, I believe that it is the equivalent of nine states. At that gives us 18 senators and well over 100, close to 200 members of the House, because of the size of two of the delegations in particular, the state of California and the state of New York. So that's where our activity will be once we move through the budget resolution, which is going on at least on the Senate side now.
Hey, this is Phil Landergan.
I know.
Phil, thank you so much.
We had to evacuate our building. There was a gas leak.
That's what we understand. And, you know, Karen Hendricks is just about to finish up her remarks, and then, Phil, we'll have you provide your thank you.
Our request for fiscal year 2007 is for $69 million, and all efforts will be made in that direction. We will also obviously need to handle and manage the fact that the language in the budget resolution in the president's budget proposal is quite clear. Unfortunately, it's all too clear that this setting under the president's budget request, as stated at the outset, no funds are included, and in effect, plans to close down the study should occur at the end of this fiscal year. So we do have our work cut out for us. In that regard, and I'm sure Phil will speak to that, as Joe mentioned, there is a new entity that is come about through the Vanguard sites and their actions and activity and their engagement of a former member of Congress, Congressman John Porter, who had been the chair of the House Labor, HHS, and Education Committee before his retirement a few years ago, and their activities will proceed, and hopefully we will all be working in collaboration and utilizing a number of all of our tools that we have before us. This is going to be, as the entire budget will be, a opportunity that it is not about hearing from the folks inside the Beltway and or those hired guns. This really needs to be constituent and grassroots-based. Members of Congress will need to hear the importance of the study, what it brings to their districts, what it brings to their states, the interaction of the data and information that is provided while in the current seven Vanguard sites, how that will impact the other sites yet to be started and determined. So with that, I will move it on to Phil.
Well, Karen, that was very, very helpful, and I'm so appreciative that the American Academy of Pediatrics has been helping to spearhead these the legislative approach to this. And so I'm very pleased that Dr. Phil Landerkin can join us and that you all, I assume, are okay.
Yes.
And I think many people on the call know that Dr. Landerkin is chair of the Department of Community and Preventative Medicine at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and also the director of the Center for Children's Health and the Environment there, and director of the new Vanguard sites for the children's studies. So,
and a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Well, there you go. Thank you.
Great.
There you go. All right. So, Phil, please, your remarks.
Okay. Well, excuse me if I repeat any of what Karen has just gone over, since obviously I didn't hear. We had a threat of a gas leak. It turned out what had happened was that there's some construction going on next door. A truck backed up to the air intake and exhaust got into the system, but we decided that the better part of valor was to evaluate the building for a few minutes until it was cleared. So, hence my delay. Apologies. So, what we have done, and what the seven Vanguard centers have done, plus Westat is the government contractor based in Rockville, Maryland, who is serving as the coordinating center for the National Children's Study. The seven Vanguard centers plus Westat have gotten together. We've each ponied up money. We've gotten a little additional money now from a couple of foundations, notably the New York Community Trust, and we have assembled a war chest somewhat greater than $250,000 to launch a campaign to save the National Children's Study. And as Karen said a few minutes ago, we had the good fortune to recruit John Porter, former member of Congress, and his team at the Washington law firm of Hogan and Hartson as our Washington rep. The there's a couple of points I'd like to amplify. First, let me explain why we chose Mr. Porter. We chose him, first of all, because he is who he is. He's a retired member of Congress, a senior appropriator, and a thoroughly decent human being. He also happens to be a Republican, which is something we were not oblivious to in the present political climate. But that's only one piece of it. Of the two things in his recent past history that particularly persuaded us to go with him were, number one, that back about four or so years ago, when he was still in the Congress, he and Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi from California held joint bipartisan hearings on the topic of children's health and the environment. And people such as Lynn Goldman, Richard Jackson, Rout Reigart, and I were all among the witnesses on that day. And it was a very warm, good day. I remember Dick Jackson leaned over to me and said, "Bottle this, it's not going to happen again for a long time." And the other thing was that a year or so ago, a group of organizations, the American Chemistry Council, the March of Dimes, I believe the Academy of Pediatrics was there, the Catholic bishops, convened a congressional briefing in D.C. about the National Children's Study. The goal was to brief members, or at least their staffs, on the Children's Study, and John Porter moderated that event. He was the maitre d', and I had a nice chat with him that day. I was one of the speakers. And so I knew that he was quite knowledgeable about the study and morally and ethically committed to its support. We reckoned that there'd be very little learning curve, which we thought was good because we knew we didn't have much time. And it was so for all those reasons that we picked him. And fortunately, a group of five or six of the center directors had gone into Washington about a month or 5 weeks ago to meet with Mr. Porter before the president's announcement came down. So even though we hadn't yet signed a contract, at least we'd begun the conversation with him. And that enabled us to move very swiftly once the word came out from the White House, and we now have a formal contract with him and with his firm. It's worth pointing out a couple of the other senior associates in his firm who are part of the effort are Paul Rogers, the former congressman from Florida, who a lot of us consider to have been the architect of Medicaid, and on the opposite side of the aisle, Robert Michel, who had been the Republican minority leader in the House for 10 or 11 years before Newt Gingrich took over that post. So there's a strong element of bipartisanship here and a great deal of expertise. Karen, did you talk about Spector Harkin?
I did.
Okay. Did you hear it just passed?
I just got an email to that effect.
Okay. So that's the first step, that there's now $7 billion that the Senate has indicated they want to see go into the two areas of health and education. Obviously, it's only a first step because that's only the Senate. The House certainly hasn't weighed in on that, nor has the White House. And even if it survives whatever compromise is made with the House of Representatives or the White House, then the second tier is to figure out within that $7 billion how does the pie get divided and how much comes to the National Children's Study, and those are all conversations for the future. But that's a very cursory roadmap of what lies ahead. Karen mentioned the organization that we've put together. Let me say a bit more about that.
In just a couple more minutes, Phil, because we do want to have time for questions.
I'll be fast.
Thank you.
The organization is called the American Children's Health Coalition. That's the name. And lawyers in the Porter firm are busy setting up two organizations properly registered with the Internal Revenue Service. The first one is a 501c4 organization. That is an organization that is legally permitted to lobby. And our first responsibility is to get that funded up so that the lobbying work gets done. But we also are in the process of standing up a 501c3, which is the one that's more familiar to all of us. It's a tax-exempt organization which cannot spend more than about perhaps 15% of its budget on lobbying. And the importance of having a parallel 501c3 is that it creates a mechanism by which individuals or foundations can make tax-exempt donations. And if we get sufficient funds raised, we can use the 501c3 to launch a national publicity campaign, take out ads, that kind of thing, depending on how big's the war chest. So we'll keep you posted on that. But right now, the first priority is working inside the Capitol. The final point I'll make is that in our public presentations and our press interviews and the like, we have been working on getting a consistent message out there. And I would like to commend this message to you for your consideration. And then if you have the chance to speak to members of the press or public, you might want to use this line of approach. Basically, the catchphrase that was coined by Dr. Ed Clark, who's the director of the center at Salt Lake City, is that he says, this is not a science project. This is about the future of America's children. And with that as a headline, he goes on to talk about rising rates of chronic disease in American kids, asthma, cancer, certain birth defects, the high and possibly rising prevalence of autism and learning disabilities. And he makes the point that this is a study that will generate the data to give us the clues to preventing or ameliorating those conditions. So he begins by putting the focus on children and the diseases that afflict children, not on the academic enterprise or the research findings. A second question that comes up a lot is people say you're going to have to wait 21 years for findings that can mean anything, and the answer is absolutely not. That we'll begin to have data that will contain clues to prevention almost as soon as the first babies in the study begin to be born. And case in point, here in New York City, Ricky Pereira at Columbia and our group at Sinai have been running studies for the last few years looking at babies' exposure in utero to pesticides like chlorpyrifos used to control cockroaches in apartments. And we found about 4 years ago, our two groups did, that babies who were exposed in utero to chlorpyrifos were born with small head circumference, which is an index of impaired brain growth in utero. We took that information and parallel data that had come from some animal labs on the toxicity of chlorpyrifos to a developing brain. We went to EPA in the Carol Browner era, and we persuaded EPA to ban residential use of the pesticide chlorpyrifos. Within 9 months, the effect of chlorpyrifos on children's brain ceased to be. That's an example of the kind of stuff that we should be able to get from this study right away. Finally, you know, within the NIH complex in Bethesda, there's some kind of a buzz going around that this study is not, people saying it's not a very good study for assessing exposure, or it's not a very good study for assessing genetics. And if you hear any of that, rebut it. Tell them that a prospective study that measures exposure in real time, which is exactly what the children's study is far and away the best vehicle in the world for properly assessing environmental exposures to children, because we have the great advantage over any study that has to look back in time that we're measuring exposures in real time as they take place. And with regard to anybody saying that the genetics are not up to par, that's false too. We've invited the Human Genome Institute to send over the best and the brightest of their tools, and we intend fully to incorporate them into the study. So that's my position. We're fighting. We are not going to roll over for this. And I cannot reemphasize too much the two closing points that Karen Hendricks made. Number one, that this isn't just about the 7 Vanguard centers. This is about the 50 sites in 35 states that have already been selected by the National Institutes of Health to be the sites of this study if the study goes forward. And the obvious political implication of that is that most of the country is going to be directly and immediately involved in running this study. It's not just a few elite medical institutions. And the final point, which is also from Karen's playbook, we really need grassroots support on this. It can't just be the academics. This will not fly unless broad coalitions of concerned parents and grandparents and citizens speak up and write their members of Congress, write their senators.
Thank you so much, Phil. That was a very thorough and helpful overview, and I think all three of your presentations give us the kind of full picture of what's happening really moment by moment, given that the Senate just passed that latest bill. So We are now going to open up this call for questions. Eleni, do you?
Yes, thank you. So Adam is our operator. If you could please put everyone in talk listen mode and let us know when that's done.
That is happening as we speak. They are gradually coming in now.
Great. And in just a moment, I'd like to go over instructions. We'd like to ask folks who are to cut down on the ambient noise, which can be considerable. I'd like to ask everyone now, Adam, are we complete with the transition?
All parties are currently in talk listen.
Great. I'd like to ask everyone, in order to put yourself in mute or to unmute yourself, please dial star 6.
Great. Questions, please.
Yes,
and please say your name and affiliation.
This is Myrna Mendlowitz with the Learning Disabilities Association.
Welcome.
I don't want to throw any water on the proceedings, but Spector Harkin has not passed yet. The vote has not occurred yet on that a budget amendment.
Okay, we got an email a little while ago saying that there are now
They're debating it on the floor now.
Seven Republican co-sponsors who are Chafee of Rhode Island, Cochran of Mississippi, Collins of Maine, DeWine of Ohio, Smith of Oregon, Noe of Maine, and Spector himself of Pennsylvania. And, yeah, you're right, it hasn't passed, but with the with that many Republicans, it's considered to be a slam dunk.
The problem is, this is Karen Hendricks, that the ranking minority, the Democrat, Kent Conrad, is not overly enthusiastic, and there may be one or two Democrats that won't support. So it's...
We know in Washington we don't count the money till we see it. We're praying and we're busily working it, but we don't count the money till we see it.
So the jury's still out.
Well, thank you for that clarification.
Yes,
so are there other questions?
This is Terry Nordbruck with Families Against Cancer and Toxics. And I wanted to know, is it time for grassroots support already? I'm champing at the bit to send my letters. Is this the right time?
Joe, do you want to? I'll start, and Joe, please add. I would submit that no time like the present time to get this started. I would strongly urge that you advise your community and your constituents and members that they need to be in this for the long haul and that you're going to be going back to the well several times. I'd look at the, as stated, the seven Vanguard sites, those specific jurisdictions and states. There are an additional couple of states because of multiple states involved with a site. And then there's a sort of second tier, and the second tier is those members who are on the Appropriations Committee on the House and the Senate side. There is going to be some overlap with those individuals who are also from the jurisdictions of the Vanguard sites, but, you know, better to be safe than sorry. And then another third tier would include those members of the House and the Senate on what are known as the authorizing committees. So that would be on the Senate side, the Health, Education, Labor and Pensions Committee, and the Education and Labor Committee on the House side. And I'd actually throw in the Energy and Commerce Committee since they do so much related to health care. And then a fourth tier is the leadership of both the House and the Senate. The leaders need to know that this is an important issue. So it's in a variety of layers. Go to the folks that you know well within your community, and not to forget that to the extent that you're working individually and collaboratively, that's also a help. Volume is going to count. And the reason and the necessity and the importance of the study, it needs to be clearly made. And noting that this is, quote, a time of shared pain has been articulated and deficit reduction, this is not the place when you add up everything else that children have not received and the benefits that they have not gotten in these just this last four-month period between cuts to Medicaid and potential cuts to discretionary programs, it's in our best interest to move forward.
Thank you. Other questions or comments?
Hi, this is Andy.
Welcome, Andy.
And, yeah, I do a special kind of teaching at a variety of schools and festivals throughout Minnesota. It's a juggling sticks. And I am interested in, when I get paid to do that teaching, to use that money to help assist in the funding of the NCS. And I was wondering if there is information that I could pass out to teachers and for students to take home to parents that would be good to promote this and make a good public ad campaign.
This is Phil Landrigan, and the answer is yes, there will be, but it doesn't exist yet because we're hastily cobbling together the necessary legal papers.
If you'll send me a quick email, I'll hold on to your name, and as soon as I have the information you're requesting, I'll gladly send it to you, or Elise, I could send it to you, and you could just put it out to everybody on this call.
That would be just fine.
I'll do it that way.
Okay.
Here's University in Camden, New Jersey.
Welcome.
Yes, I'm interested in knowing whether or not the study, I did get to the APHA presentation of the study last December, but are we going to be able to pull out urban centers by all the other things I'm seeing on the website, urban centers, because all the sites in New Jersey are sites that have no urban center. And so the state data does not help me. So I'm wondering if we're going to be able to pull out urban centers separately from some of the other geographies.
Hi, this is Dr. Landrigan. The answer is yes. The way the sites were selected is that in the aggregate, they are intended to be representative of the American population, or more specifically, to be representative of the babies that are born during the 4 or the 5 years of recruitment to the study. There was also a very deliberate effort made when those sites were selected to include urban, suburban, and rural. And indeed, you'll see that mix even among the Vanguard centers. Now, the study was not set up in such a way that it's going to give data that are specific to any one state. So it wouldn't give data that are specific to New Jersey or to Wyoming or to California. It's going to give data that cover the U.S. But then within that, there'll be enough data that we can speak about Northeast, Southeast, Northwest, Southwest, and also about urban, suburban, and rural. So, for example, the center that we have here in New York is the borough of Queens, intensely urban, a whole range of income from wealthy to very poor, the nation's most ethnically diverse community with 150 different languages spoken. But I think we're going to learn things about urban centers that will be applicable to cities like Camden.
Hello, this is Myrta Sullivan from Chicago. I work with the Great Lakes Pediatric Environmental Center, and I have a question for involvement with the Vanguard. I had contacted the lead person of the Vanguard in Wisconsin, and because we at UIC, a number of us in epidemiology and maternal child health, and also people over at Stroger Hospital, which is one of the largest public hospitals in the country, we had expressed interest in working with that center, and I don't know how how proactive the Vanguard centers are in trying to elicit help, especially in a large urban city metropolitan area like Chicago, and if they want grassroots support, people who work at a public hospital certainly should be part of it, and I think that they may have to be a little bit more aggressive in getting people involved, like in the region and especially in the city like Chicago.
Yeah. Well, I can't speak for the folks in Wisconsin, but I'll answer it generically. The first responsibility of each of the Vanguard centers is to recruit the designated number of children, which is 250 a year,
mm-hmm.
In
in the geographic area that they've been assigned. And the Wisconsin people have been assigned Waukesha County, which is just west of Milwaukee.
Right.
So that's their primary responsibility. Now, there's been a great deal of talk in among the Vanguard Senate about doing what are called adjunct studies. And the adjunct studies are supplementary studies that would be done in addition to the core study. And I know, for example, our center here in New York City has been actively inviting adjunct proposals, and we've gotten four or five beauties. We obviously, given the current funding crunch, we've not been able to move forward with any of those, but we have been reaching out to people in the various communities, academic, concerned citizens, NGOs, groups that are concerned about particular diseases, and communicating with them. So that might be the way to...
Well, yeah.
The trouble is it's not going to move until the core funding is in place.
I know, but then it's like a catch-22, because how can we go to our congresspeople to say, we think this is so vital, which we do, and we will do
sure.
it anyway, but it doesn't lend a lot of credibility if we're not really participating in any meaningful way.
Yeah, no, I've been in touch with some people in your institution, like Peter Orris and Dan Rehorchuk.
Right.
And my understanding is that, is it Chicago itself or Cook County or one of your counties right around Cook is slated to be picked up in the next wave?
Yeah, Will and DuPage, I think.
Okay.
I know Will and DuPage. I think those are the two.
So that,
but
that's
not Chicago.
Okay, but that's the way you can get most directly involved when it's in your own state. But in the meantime, all I can suggest is that you speak to Maureen Durkin and Christine Kronk, who are the two principals.
I did call her, but they didn't really.
I think right now they're frozen until we know what happens with the money, because nothing can happen until.
Well, that's what I'm saying. We really want to get involved with some of this grassroots effort. Even if I know.
Let me
on hold, but
send me an email. Send me an email, and I'll be glad to speak to Chris and Maureen, because I'll be with them next week. We're all going
to
be together in Washington.
We want to try to support them, because we know in the future that we could probably have some type of collaboration.
I'm sure you will. I'm
so
sure
we would like to
will.
Support in this grassroots effort.
Yep.
Thank you so much.
Sandy Kane.
We have about 10 minutes left.
Hello.
Other questions?
Hello.
Yes.
Sandy Kane from New Jersey.
Hello.
Yes, Sandy.
I'm with several environmental groups and also an affected concerned citizen. We were contaminated in certain contaminants in our area. But where does New Jersey stand? Because I want to go to congressmen and legislators now on certain things. Where does New Jersey stand in all this? We have that.
A list has been published by the National Institutes of Health of the three that have been selected. And if memory serves me correctly, there are several New Jersey counties that were picked up, but because I had to evacuate my building just when I would have been preparing for this phone call, I don't have the list in front of me.
Those counties are Burlington, Middlesex, Passaic, and Warren.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay. Gloucester's not in there? Okay.
Apparently not. No.
Okay.
There was just selected counties, which, as I said a few minutes ago, in the aggregate are supposed to be representative of the whole United States, but clearly it's like a Nielsen survey where some people are picked and others are not, and it's the luck of the draw.
So, in other words, the county can't come in now. The CDC did a study on us years ago, back in 97, and at that point...
Is that Brick Township?
Monroe Township.
Okay.
We've been a super fund and a spill fund. And at that point, there were, it was conclusive of the problems. It was inconclusive of the contaminants causing the problems.
Yes.
So that's where, I want to push, especially I'm involved with the schools right now, and I would like to push to health is important, because I'm a paramedical esthetician, so I see a lot.
Right.
So that's where I'd love to push in this, would it help us, in other words?
I think the issue, I can't speak for the National Institutes of Health, but my understanding is that they have basically selected a group of counties, and they knew from day one that there were many, many counties with problems that they weren't capturing, because the target was to do 100,000 children who would be a statistical sample of the whole country. The reality is there's 4 million babies born in this country every year, and there was no way they could ever get sufficient budget to enroll every baby in the study, and so they had to select certain counties and exclude others.
Okay. Thank you.
Probably time for two or three more questions.
Hi, this is Kathy Lawson from the Learning Disabilities Association of America.
Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you. As many of the other organizations on the line have done, LDA has worked long and hard to support the National Children's Study. And so I was wondering, will there be prepared media materials available through the American Children's Health Coalition so that we can all stay on point, such as templates for letters to the editor?
That is the intent, yes.
Uh-huh. And when do you think that might be?
Within weeks.
Within weeks?
Yeah, right now we're just, you know, it's like a rugby game, and we're in the scrum there in the Senate. But as soon as we get a little breathing room, we're going to start putting that stuff together.
Great. Phil, do let me know, this is Elise,
yep.
So that I can circulate, or Kay can circulate that information more broadly.
Will do. Thanks.
As soon as possible.
Thank you, Kelly. Elise, this is Karen Hendricks. For those folks who want Tuesday, March 21st, there is a Senate briefing that will be held that starts soon. From South Dakota, and Tim Johnson from South Dakota have convened. It starts at 1:30, from 1:30 to 3. If you all have a little time, making calls to the 100 members of the Senate and urging their staff to attend would be most helpful and a little immediate gratification for us all.
Elise, this is Michael Lerner. I have a question for Phil Landrigan.
This is
a question I've heard from others who are deeply supportive of the study but have the following concern. The concern is that you might get some funding, but it might get cut back enough so that the initial intensive screening processes might be compromised, and therefore the capacity to really learn from the follow-up would be deeply compromised. So the question is, what protects the National Children's Study from, sort of marginal funding if it were to succeed in a way that the expensive, early screening processes were hurt, and therefore the whole study is hurt as a result?
Yeah, I think that perhaps the concern is overstated. The logistics for the early screening are that women will be recruited into the study as early as possible in pregnancy. In fact, the hope is to recruit 25% before they conceive, but women of an appropriate age who are trying to get pregnant. And then the plan is, as soon as these women sign up, either just before conception or shortly after, to get samples of body fluids from them, blood and urine basically, and send those off to CDC chemical analysis. And I think that's the critical element. The two critical elements are, one, the timing of the recruitment, namely very early in pregnancy, and number two, the collection of the samples that go to CDC. If we can maintain sufficient core funding to accomplish those two steps, everything else follows.
So there's not a problem with expensive exposure monitoring.
A lot of us think that the very best exposure monitoring consists of monitoring the
blood itself,
the internal mirror of the
okay.
the pregnant woman, because that's after all the mirror in which the fetus, the unborn child, lives. And if I had to make a choice, if I had limited dollars, I would get those fluids on the mums before I spent dollars doing, for example, dust sampling or air sampling.
That's very reassuring. Thank you.
Hi,
we have time for one more question.
Yes, I'm Betsy Easterson.
And you're where?
I'm from Corona, California, and I'm a student of psychology.
Great, Betsy.
Yes, hi. I'm wondering, as I could be biased, I'm a mother of a 3-year-old autistic boy. And I'm wondering what the drive is with this, with autism, as it's up 600% in 9 years, and be it environmental cause, be it whatever is to blame, the great importance of it and being a mostly neurological problem. What is the drive with that?
Okay. Let me begin by answering that autism is very much on the list of conditions that the national study is geared to find answers to. The numbers here that I understand is that approximately one baby out of every 166 babies born now in the U.S. Is autistic, and so that means in every 1,000 babies that are enrolled into the study, we'll get 7 or 8 with autism, and if we do get the funding to recruit the full 100,000, then we'll have somewhere in the neighborhood of 700 to 800 children in the study who develop autism. From the cold-blooded perspective of a statistician, not the human perspective, obviously, but from the statistical perspective, those are good numbers. Because with that many children in the study who have autism, I think we have very high statistical probability of being able to capture environmental factors that cause autism or trigger it or are predisposed to it or that interact with the genes that may also be involved in autism.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Compared, for example, a few years ago, the CDC, ATSDR, did a very intensive study in New Jersey, Brick Township, where there was somebody from New Jersey will know the exact numbers, but my recollection is 15 or 20 children with autism, and that was considered the biggest field study of looking for environmental causes of autism to this time. So do the math, it's 15 or 20 versus 7 or 800. We'll have much higher likelihood of capturing what might be there.
Well, Andrew can just say that.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
And we're going to have to wrap up right now, and I just want to thank all three of our speakers. This is incredibly informative. We will have follow-up information on the K website, and I just want to now turn it over to Eleni for the final comments and logistical information.
Thank you, Elise. I just want to mention for folks that came on the line a little late that our next regularly scheduled national partnership call is scheduled for next week, March 22nd, at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, and the topic is Endocrine Disruptors and Environmental Health, 10 years after the seminal book Our Stolen Future was published. And if you would like to join that call, please email Julia Varshavsky at julia@healthandenvironment.org. Thank you, everyone, for joining us, and thank you to the speakers. We look forward to talking with you on next week's call. Bye-bye.